And we will begin our meeting with a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, which simply is a lodge of students who are associated for a common cause, and that cause is the promulgation of the philosophy, the principles of the philosophy of theosophy. This declaration is the one and only guiding principle of the lodge and of all the United Lodges of Theosophists throughout the world. And it sets forth our policy. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declaration and purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And if at any time any of us consider joining as an associate, you're certainly welcome to pick up an associate's card at the table and bring it home with you, reflect on it. What the card says simply is, the following is the form signed by associates of the United Lodge of Theosophists. Being in sympathy with the purposes of this lodge, as set forth in its declaration, I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate, it being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself determine. And if that's of interest to you, please speak to the individual sitting at the book table after the meeting. Now, we carry on two meetings per week. And big announcement for 2015, our meeting times changed on Wednesday night. So the new meeting times from on Wednesday night is 5:15 to 7:15, the library is open. And then from 7:30 to 8:30 is the meeting. 7:30 to 8:30 is the Wednesday night meeting. The Wednesday night meeting, we're studying the ocean of theosophy. We just have completed mind, higher mind, and lower mind, and we are just moving into three full chapters on reincarnation. It's the biggest or the longest, given the most time in this study of the ocean of theosophy, and we'll be studying it for weeks and weeks to come. So the first class on reincarnation is this Wednesday. Then, of course, Sundays we have from 11 to 12. Every Sunday we're here. For the month of January, the umbrella topic for consideration this month is the path of spiritual evolution. Next Sunday, the title for the talk will be The Plan and Purpose of Evolution. And today's talk is The Necessity for Human Perfectibility. The Necessity for Human Perfectibility. The United Lodge of Theosophists is entirely sustained by voluntary contributions of time, money, and effort, And any contributions that are offered are certainly welcome, and we are grateful for it, but there's no obligation imposed or implied. By the way, if you have questions regarding the philosophy, you know, talk to people during the meeting or afterwards, but also there's a book table in the foyer where you can purchase Straight Line Theosophical Literature, books, pamphlets, and magazines at cost to the lodge. Okay? So our topic for today is the necessity for human perfectibility, which is a pretty big topic. So we're going to carry this topic as a panel discussion. There'll be two presentations, and after the second presenter is finished, then there will be plenty of time for talks, discussion, questions, and contributions from everybody. So, the necessity for human perfectibility. So often, we all probably know so many people around us, among our friends and family and ourselves, who really wonder what's going on. Really, why am I here? Especially when we really get into the, you know, am I just here to make a living? Or are we here to just raise the kids? Isn't there more to life than... Well, sometimes things get tough. Some people think they're just here to pay taxes, depending, right? With respect to this, one idea that's offered, the theosophical view of why we're here, is that the purpose of life is to be fully initiated into the knowledge of the divine being who we truly are, and to be initiated into the full knowledge of the divine being who we truly are. Well, that's a big thing to think about, and you know, we got a lot going on, so how long is this going to take? The idea here is, through studying the philosophy as we're raising our children and as we're making a living and as we're doing everything else along the way, that it could be, if we look at life from the right perspective, we will pick up lessons along the way that actually contribute to a deeper understanding of ourselves, and therefore to a deeper understanding of our true divine nature by learning the lessons as we go, as we interact with our fellow souls, families, friends. But to reach this point, we are told in the philosophy that man must, under law, develop what's called his faculties of perceptions. He must develop certain qualities and attributes that we all have inherent within ourselves, but generally many of them are latent, are not yet awakened. And so the inherent qualities and attributes, so we have to do this so that we can better recognize ourselves for who we truly are right now. We don't become more spiritual. We already are spiritual beings. What we become is more able to recognize and be aware of truly who we are and act from the true basis. So this doesn't happen by obeying the orders of a priest or a rabbi or a cleric or a Brahmin, according to his interpretation of his particular scriptures. On the other hand, it can happen by taking direction from teachers who point out the way, such as the teachers of theosophy through their writings of the philosophy. It is helpful to take direction as such, but this cannot happen if the individual adheres to false ideas, even if he is a good person and really believes these ideas. If he thinks and lives according to false ideas, these false ideas will stunt his evolution or will stunt his perfectibility. So in this talk, we're going to kind of equate the evolution of the human being to his perfectibility. They're pretty much one and the same. Now, the necessity for human perfectibility, or for human evolution, we say the necessity, that's the title of the talk, the necessity for human perfectibility. It indicates that perfectibility is a prerequisite for something, as in once we have perfected ourselves, then something can happen. It's a necessity. We must evolve. Well, the human being must evolve. And this does not mean that we must be saved by someone else who sacrifices his life for our sins. The human being must evolve. And that doesn't mean that we must be forgiven by a God who created us originally as sinners. The idea of human perfectibility is that we all have inherent within us qualities that are perfectible and can only be perfected by the individual. And this requires effort. So for instance, if we go to math class, to study mathematics requires effort. It's the result of this, by the result of this effort, we can then think more clearly in certain ways. So in a small way, then that means we've intellectually evolved in a certain way because we've learned certain things about math. But the issue here is not so much what did you learn about math that contributes to your evolution. The issue is the effort that you put forth to learn that required the use of will and the concentration of mind to learn that. And the more we're able to use will and concentrate the mind, that's what we're talking about with intellectual and spiritual evolution. So, of course, it's insufficient just to show up for math class. You're not going to learn it. We have to do the work. So, too, if we are just born on planet Earth, that's insufficient to perfect ourselves. There are things that we have to do. Just getting by or making a living or being nice to people, yes, things like this are necessary, they're required, but they're insufficient to perfect ourselves. So the evolution of man requires that, this phrase that you'll hear in the philosophy, that man must raise himself by the self. Man must raise himself by the self. Well, how do we do this? That's what the teachings of the philosophy of theosophy are all about. And the teachers of theosophy, through their writings, they make suggestions to us on what we should do. And they point in the general direction. Are we open to taking the direction and investigating for ourselves if that makes sense, if those ideas are true? Because it's the individual who must, under karma, must do the work himself. And we each have to engender within ourselves the means and the methods by which we individually evolve, because it doesn't happen unless we make the effort. This is not a process of compulsion or prohibition. There's no theosophical priest who says you have to do this and you're not allowed to do that. But it is a process of unseen sacrifice and service. Having successfully made the effort to evolve oneself toward the end in view, man finds himself in a place where he has developed intellectually, spiritually, emotionally, psychically, physically, through karma over the course of many lives, to the highest degree possible that a human being can evolve. And that's simply what it is. That is a perfected human being who has evolved every aspect of himself to the highest degree possible. In other words, by doing that, he has fulfilled this necessity. He has fulfilled that prerequisite. But what is the perfection of a human being a prerequisite of? And the answer to that question will be considered in the second part of our talk.
In the first part, we heard a few points that we're going to pick up and carry through as a theme in our in this presentation. And one is the idea of that the ideal and the fact that there have been down through the ages individual human beings who have perfected or developed their spiritual, mental, psychic, physical capacities to the highest possible degree, and so for themselves and through themselves have obtained a true realization of the self and firsthand knowledge that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. So this accumulated body of wisdom, this wisdom religion, this scientific religion, this religious science, is the wisdom of the ages. So we can take comfort in the fact that we are not the first, or this generation is not the first to take this path or consider these ideas. This has been going on for ages. And so even though we have to do it for ourselves, we can take the benefit of those who have gone before us and pointed out the way. So what we'd like to do is share the philosophy or the philosophical principles, the theory, if you will, based on their investigations into the very heart of nature, the laws governing the evolution of nature and of the human being. And we think to start out with, we might say that part of this process of perfecting oneself to gain a truer realization of our divine nature means that we will become ourselves self-consciously aware of the tremendous interdependence in all departments of nature. We cannot make the effort to perfect ourselves without in some degree lifting up the progress of other human beings, and likewise their efforts have an effect on us as well. So in that sense, our interdependence makes it a necessity. So our necessity for human perfectibility goes back to what Theosophy calls the deific principle, the God idea. And we hesitate to use the term God because in so many traditions and in so many people's minds, that word conjures up the idea of a supreme being who creates the universe and all of human beings. Instead, we'd like to propose the idea that this first eternal rootless root, this absolute one reality, is infinite, eternal, and that periodically coming forth and into manifestation and disappearing under cyclic law, there come a whole succession of universes, each universe being a further perfection of the possibility that lies inherent in that deific principle. So if the entire universe, we might say, is impelled forward through the pervasiveness of this divine principle, why are we not left out of that impulse as well? So it is necessary that we become aware of this process so we don't delay or obstruct the progress of others. It is in fact, this deific principle is in fact the basis of our inherent human perfectibility. And that is a perhaps new and strange idea to us because we have bombarded around us in so many forms the idea of our weakness or insufficiency or vulnerability or dependence. So this, although a basic idea, if considered and applied, can be very profound in its effect on how we view our world. So if we just begin with the universal consideration before we come to the particular, at the beginning, we might say, of a manifestation of a universe, we read in the Bible, for example, and the light came forth in the darkness, and the darkness knew it not. Or in the Old Testament, and God created light, and it was good. The whole idea that this first manifestation of what we call spirit is like a light. It's universal consciousness, awareness, or the term, we're going to use the term spirit to differentiate it from that which is eternally the one absolute reality. So this spirit or universal soul pervades all manifested life. It is universal consciousness in life. And so everything in nature, from the smallest atom in the grain of sand to the largest sun in the solar systems of a galaxy, everything in nature is alive, is conscious and intelligent on its own plane, in its own degree. There is no dead, inert matter. And so there is intelligence evolving in the mineral, the vegetable, and the animal kingdom. In the philosophy, the term is used for this ray or this center of divine intelligence and life that is moving through all of nature. It's called the monad. And it suggests to us the idea that it is both spirit and matter. Just like light is matter and energy, it is both that intelligence and substance. It is universal. And it is just, it might say it's the electric power, the vivifying power in all of nature that pushes things forward, just as like the electric current drives a motor. And so all of nature, all the kingdoms, they're all impelled forward by natural impulse. That impulse is an expression of this divine intelligence, this divine light or spirit, but it's also a manifestation of that universal law of cause and effect, of periodicity. And so in each of the kingdoms, whether we're speaking of mineral, vegetable, animal, that intelligence can be expressed in a different way because the form only allows it a certain way to be manifested. So we think of electricity, for example, a universal energy, and yet it can only be expressed, and to the degree of what's expressed depends on the engine or the vehicle it's working through. So the degree of the light bulb or the capacity of the heater or the generator or the wind or the turbine engines, so forth. The particular being in each kingdom shows intelligence in different degrees. So what we see in the mineral kingdom in terms of attraction and repulsion and cohesion and selective affinity for certain other minerals is an expression of this universal intelligence. We can recognize it more in the plant kingdom because we can see a definite sensitivity to light, to environmental conditions, to moisture, towards conditions of the soil and the environment. And in certain capacities, the plant not only develops protective mechanisms, but communicative mechanisms, and is sensitive to not only nature, but to other beings, we might say, in the plant kingdom. So we see that sensitivity or sensation. And then in the animal kingdom, we see all degrees of instinctive behavior. So in one sense, we might say that all this intelligence evolving in the lower kingdom is a perfect reflection of universal law and that in divine spiritual intelligence. Nature cannot fail in that sense, unless it's retarded, corrupted, and interfered with by the free will and self-conscious activity of human beings. Yes, we get in the way of nature, or we can lift it up. So, although nature cannot fail in that sense, it is a perfect reflection of intelligence in nature. The kingdoms are a perfect reflection of intelligence in nature. They can only go so far. through natural impulse, just as a child left on its own can only evolve as a human being so far. It needs the interaction and relationship with some higher degree of experience and intelligence in the parent and the teacher and the friend to mix and mingle with it, to blend its experience and lift it up, to initiate it, as it were, into a higher degree of expression. So too with the intelligence, the lives developing in nature all around us, they need contact and interaction with the divine self-consciousness in man. Yes, as a human being, we are instinctive, we have sensitivity, we have cohesive and electric, magnetic, repulsive, attractive parts in our nature, but there's one thing that we have that the lower kingdoms do not, and that is the capacity for self-conscious choice and free will to determine which way will we go, to analyze, to reflect, to see the good and the bad, and to make moral choices based on that. And so it is the mingling of all these intelligences from the lower kingdoms and the divine consciousness in man, the mingling in the human being, which is nature's factory, laboratory, if you will, that all this perfection is brought about. So what we need to keep in mind is, yes, it is necessary for there to be human perfectibility and for us to gain full self-conscious knowledge. But it is also necessary for us to pursue a path of human perfectibility in order to raise up the lives, the consciousness, and all the kingdoms, not only around us, but within us. And as suggested in the first talk, it may be necessary for us to pursue a path of individual perfection or perfectibility to gain self-conscious knowledge, but it is not sufficient to reach that higher degree unless we take up this idea of service and responsibility to all other beings, including those in the lower kingdoms. As human beings, we have that privilege, that power, that responsibility to become a co-worker with nature. So the take-home practical message is, whether you're making a New Year's resolution or you're trying to be the best person you can be according to your own ideal and free thought, whether you're trying to follow the ethics, the highest ethics of your particular religious tradition and all religious traditions, the whole purpose is not to do it just for one's own salvation. And there's kind of a tinge of spiritual selfishness. And in that endeavor, it will never lead to the highest realization. But we can try to be the best we can be, the highest possible expression, in order to put that development at the service of all of life, those around us and those conscious beings below us, raising all of life up to the possibility of that highest perfection in the course of time. So that is a wide, universal, we might say, perspective. And we struggle to try to realize it. We grant that. But this is our heritage. It's our birthright. This is the accumulated wisdom of human beings who have gained a higher understanding of life, its purpose, as we'll hear more of next week. And this is the path they point out to those who wish to pursue the same path of spiritual evolution. Now, we're sure you have some questions and comments from your own experience and thoughts on why human perfectibility is a necessity.
Yes.
We heard what was just said about bringing up all the other kingdoms and service and so forth. But practically, we live in such a selfish time and very materialistic. How practically can we put forth this effort without getting tangled up in our personality and our our desires. Is there a path that is shown that we can, that will help us, you know, travel this path to some kind of perfectibility?
So the question is, in a practical way, in the real world, what do we do? What's step number one? Well, the teachings say, really, first, in our own words, choose your friends wisely. Surround yourself with people with whom you're like-minded, who have a similar intention, who are devoted to similar goals. That's the first. And study yourself, and study those around you. Question yourself. Question everything that you think. Why do I really believe this is true? And question those around you. And it is said that time will mature. The individual will come to realize the clear path for himself and his group. And when he and they have fit themselves to be the better able to teach and serve others, well, it's recognized they'll find themselves in the presence of ones who know, who hold the philosophy, who hold the knowledge of the keys to growing in this way from humanity, except for those who have done the work to learn it. And it's all a matter, it's not a matter of baptism, it's not a matter of, you know, the major aha moment, but it's an initiatory process all along the way, which unfolds according to the effort that each personally puts into it.
So the very reality that we cannot deny, that there are obstacles, that there is chaos in life, that there is suffering, that there are obstructions, that there is selfishness, is precisely to the point that because we are interdependent, we cannot develop ourselves alone to the highest possible degree unless we make some effort in the process to lift up, to improve the conditions around us. So the first idea would be, forget yourself. Forget how difficult it is for you. Forget your own weaknesses and perhaps recognize selfishness. Forget your strengths. Forget how good you think you are or how bad you think you are. That's not the point. The point is, in the course of time, you will become better. Instead, recognize around you that there are those who suffer more than you do, who know less more than you do, who are incapable of helping themselves for various reasons, and focus one's attention, all one's knowledge and skill that they think they have, on making their lives better. Because in that effort, one cannot lift them up without, in some degree, helping oneself as well. And that is, in fact, the heart doctrine, the emphasis of theosophy. When we say, what is the path of spiritual evolution from the point of view of a theosophist, of whatever theosophical association, it's not one's own individual salvation or spiritual progress to some imagined height of knowledge and power, but rather the effort to lift everything up, all of nature up, to a higher degree, to become a co-worker with nature.
Question in the back?
We were just wondering, we heard the expression free thinker. An individual might think of himself as a free thinker, but we're just wondering, how free of a thinker is that individual?
Mm-hmm. Well, the term free thinker is a historical and philosophical one, but it basically relates to a group of individuals who don't identify themselves with any specific organized dogma and creed, don't hold affiliation to any particular religious expression. And they claim to be themselves free and independent of such and determined to try to figure out reality and what is true for themselves. And then in that sense, their effort is very noble. But that's only the scratching the surface. The real problem for freedom of mind is not so much detaching or becoming less dependent on outer authority, but freeing the mind from the inner shackles, the influence of our own assumed and presumed false notions that we've picked up from others, to recognize that they're false, to have the power and strength and discrimination to do that, and also to free ourselves from the influence of the passions and desires that color and prejudice all our various notions. So to be a free thinker is in that sense to really know oneself in the light of something higher. And while in a sense a theosophist is a free thinker, is advised to check, test, and verify everything they hear, not only within these rooms, but outside as well. Test, check, and verify it for oneself. Don't just blindly accept it, whatever you hear. Even though we're encouraged to that, we are at the same time once recognizing that such wisdom is around us, that has been known for ages, we develop an open ear, an open eye, a willingness to maybe not be so free and independent, but at least willing to listen and learn from what others have acquired in the past. So yes, we're free thinkers, but we're also have to be open-minded to accumulated wisdom from others.
And so along that vein, as was said during the talk, you know, it's not enough just to be nice. Often we hear, well, my motive is pure, you know, but such and such happened. Well, theosophy says, yeah, pure motive is good, but motive is nothing in the absence of right thinking. And theosophy gives us a basis for right thinking, and that basis is recognize who you are, that you are an eternal soul in evolution, and everyone else and everything else around us is. And if we think and act from that basis, then and maintain a pure motive, then it will be much more natural for us to live the golden rule. Yes.
Well, when this idea has come up amongst friends, they point or they say, "Well, why don't you read this?" And we look at it, and it's from another culture, and it's like over 4,000 years old. And we wonder, what kind of relevance would that have to me, that it was written so long ago, and in another culture, it was, you know, different than ours. It's called the Bhagavad Gita. Now, is that a helpful something for us to read and consider and to try to concentrate on?
Well, when it comes to, so the question is, you know, there are so many different scriptures, so many claims to spiritual authority made by different religions and different priests, etc. How do we know whether it's true, whether it's not true? Well, if we take the time and make the effort to study, learn, talk about, and apply the principles of theosophy, then, when we read different scriptures of the world in the light of theosophy, things become brighter to us very often than typically might be clear to those who are actually in that particular religion. We'll give an example. If we think about Genesis. Genesis, read in the light of theosophy, is the story of the evolution of man. It's right there in full view, if you understand the theosophical perspective of evolution. According to the fundamental Orthodox traditional church, no. Genesis says God created man. And so with respect to the Bhagavad Gita, how can that really still apply to us now? Well, Bhagavad Gita, who knows who really wrote it, but obviously whoever did had an understanding of the nature of who he or they really are. And what they wrote can be read by so many different people raised in different modes of thought that it can be studied from a psychological point. It can be studied for an emotion. There are seven different viewpoints that it can be studied by. And because it is, you know, if something is in principle the truth, then it doesn't matter when it's read in the history of man, it's still going to have certain applications to those who are looking for the truth.
So to go back to a previous comment from the chair, the statement was made that theosophy gives us a basis for right thinking. Well, why is that not a dogmatic statement? Couldn't you hear that from any pulpit, any book? Our philosophy, our approach gives us a basis for right thinking. So how are we to, as it says, discern what is right thinking when you hear so many different expressions of what right thinking is? And so we are given a test. And the test is this. Has the idea stood the test of time? As said, is it true today? Was it true 4,000 years ago? Is it true in any human being, regardless of their race, their condition, their intelligence? If so, it reflects the human condition the way it was today as it was 4,000 or longer years ago. Is it true whether it's taught in Africa or Asia or ancient America or India or Scandinavia? Does it matter, you know, what culture we're born in? If it's an idea that's true and recognized and right, it would be independent. So if an idea is universally expressed and recognized as a fact and applied as a fact, everywhere, in all times, by all people, under certain no conditions, and no one's left out, and the results are always demonstrated to have the effect expected, then we say that's a right idea. But that leaves it up to the individual to test, check, and verify the ideas that they carry with their in their mind, to take an inventory and see if their ideas are just right for them, or whether they're right under this universal standard. And so theosophy gives us a ruler by which to measure our ideas against that which might be a universal, timeless idea, such as found in the Bible, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Old Testament, in the ancient American scriptures, in the Popol Vuh, for example, to test our ideas against those and decide which is not more right, but which is truer in all circumstances, and begin to act from that perspective. Because spiritual knowledge really is a knowledge of that which, like spirit, is universal, all-pervasive, and everlasting.
Yes.
Well, we personally become very confused that so much in the world is so personal, and it's exclusive. There's exclusivity everywhere, and we're baffled by that. What is theosophy's, or what is this philosophy's approach to life in that sense? Is it personal? Is it exclusive? Is this philosophy exclusive only for certain people, or what should we come to understand as this purpose?
Well, there are several aspects of the idea of exclusivity mentioned there, in a sense, one being is theosophy exclusively for certain people, certain nations? We would say no, it's the accumulated wisdom of the ages and the individuals who have checked, tested, and verified and mastered these ideas have come from all nations and races of humanity, so, and have given it out in portions in varying degrees to all the nations and races of humanity down through the ages. So it's not exclusive in that sense, nor is it exclusive in doctrine, because the ideas are put out for any human being, I said, not to accept or blindly, but rather to check, test, and verify. So one is free to be a free thinker, or a prejudiced one. If you want to hold on to your ideas, that's fine. If you cherish the traditions in which you believe, that's fine. But what theosophy would add to that is, well, go back to your own tradition, the one that you cherish and you believe to be the true, and take what you learn in theosophy to see that within that tradition there are some other ideas that you may not have realized, and that there are aspects of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, that all treat the same, teach this, not just the same ethics, but the same fundamental ideas. And so that maybe your cherishness of a particular tradition will be tempered by at least a tolerance and a respect and a brotherliness towards others. Buddha taught, honor your own tradition or religion, but respect and be tolerant of all others. So in our world of relativities, perhaps that's the best we can hope to achieve at this time.
So also with respect to this exclusivity, there was a day when, by definition, anything theosophical or the system of thought that we call theosophy was excluded per se from all societies in the world. You know, after the Dark Ages came the Enlightenment, spearheaded by Freemasons to try to open the mind and educate the mind of the Western world. And after that is the introduction of the philosophy of theosophy as a public presentation. There's a lot of things that we talk about here in the lodge where during the Middle Ages, forget it, you wouldn't live through it if the local authorities knew you were talking about it. There are still places on earth. We have relatives who live in places on earth where if they were talking about this and people hear things would go crazy. So what we're speaking of here today in other times was the Gnostic, the Sufi, in the older, earlier Freemasons, the Rosicrucian ideas that had to stay under the table until freedom of expression, until man was open enough, such as with the founding of the United States, to allow this freedom of expression. Prior to that, it hadn't really been in the world since the fall of the Library of Alexandria before the Dark Ages. So fortunately, it's back. We're back, right? And we have this opportunity. The thing is, the Western world, it's introduced into the Western world because the Western world most needs it, because it's most materialistic and was the newest, so would be able to adopt the ideas the fastest and then share them back with the dogmatic Eastern side of the world, which also has, we talk about the wonderful East in terms of their ancient philosophy, but that doesn't mean that in the modern day they're not a materialistic society as well, because they actually are in many ways, the different religions of the East today. So we introduce it to them as well. Yes, in the back.
Are there any examples of these perfected people in the last couple of centuries?
So, okay, so the question is, you know, can we have specific examples of those who have perfected themselves. Well, on the first, we have to look at, is this idea, for instance, of human perfectibility, can that be found some way throughout time and across civilizations throughout the whole world? And the answer is a resounding yes. It is a universal idea. So we have examples in Jesus Christ, in Krishna, in Buddha, and other great saviors of the world, quote unquote, the use of the word savior. But it's not limited to them. And there's a tendency that those in certain religions will say, well, ours is the real perfected. No, theosophy would say, stop, really doesn't matter. What matters is that, is do we understand the concept of the inherent perfectibility of human beings? Do we know that it's happened? Can each individual prove to himself that somewhere, somehow it has happened? Because if it has, all that simply means is they were as we were, as we are now. And therefore, we can be as they are now. So the last thing the world needs is for a bunch of theosophists to start pointing fingers at who's a Mahatma and who's not. It doesn't matter. What matters is that we demonstrate that we're not here to tell people to change. You know, that implies that you're not good enough, so you should change. That's not it. But improve. Look at yourself, question yourself, study yourself, learn and improve. And the effort that is made in improving oneself, if we're doing it with the right motive and with the right knowledge, what we're really saying is that is the process of perfectibility, or that is the raising of the self by the self. Yes?
If this didn't understood correctly, I think in the beginning, one of the speakers made the distinction between spirit manifesting and God, or could the speaker please expand on that?
Yes. It is difficult to speak about that which cannot be spoken of, that we don't have the words to express, because what are words? They're symbols, they're limitations, and we're trying to express something which is boundless, infinite. So let's use instead for the absolute, that eternal, unchanging reality, the idea of space. And we might say space is everywhere, it's in everything. Its existence does not depend on anything. Everything exists in space, everything comes forth from space, returns to space. Space is unchanged, untouched. It's absolute. There was no beginning, end, or end to space. If we can understand that concept, then we can begin to understand the notion of an ultimate supreme reality we call deity, which is, in that sense, like space. But now think of the idea of air. Of wind. Air is all pervasive. It moves. It has currents. It can develop in various conditions. It moves in space. We know that there are areas of space, while not a vacuum, have no air in that sense. So air is a manifestation all pervasive within there. And so if we think of this absolute, which is like darkness to us because we cannot conceive of it, even though it's the absolute reality. We cannot know it because our minds are too limited. The first manifestation of that would be like light. We call it spirit. It's the divine, the manifested deity, the presence. But it's periodic. Yes, it's all pervasive, but it only lasts as an expression for that particular period of evolution, and then at the end, it itself, because it's a manifestation, absorbs or returns back into its homogeneous absolute condition. So spirit is like that, the movement, the presence, the divine inspiration we feel within our nature that we call the God within, the divine presence, is that spirit. It's the most we can know of that absolute, is its manifested expression. And in the philosophy, it says that all souls are fundamentally identical with that universal oversoul, but that universal oversoul itself is but a periodic expression of the one absolute eternal. So it gets us away from any idea that a God is a limited or an exclusive being that has any personal or human attributes, that you can pray to God and God will listen to your prayers and decide who's going to live and who's going to die and who's going to suffer. The space has no ears. Space has no mouth. It is. It's eternal. And in that sense, it helps us understand that this divine essence you speak of is impersonal. And yet it is the very heart of our being. It what binds everything, universes, solar system, all beings together in one infinite whole. So once again, we're reaching for words to paint a picture of that which we can truly only understand in our own intuition and divine consciousness.
Yes.
In recent years, there's been not a new philosophy, but a philosophy brought before the general public. And its opponents were Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand. And it was a celebration of the individual, which said that the individual's talents and gifts should be used by the individual without any hindrance or obligation to the rest of society. And it should be used according to how the individual saw it. How does that rank in comparison to what theosophy says about the rights and privileges of the individual and its elevation?
Well, in what limited writing we've read from Ayn Rand, what theosophy would agree with is this extreme position that she takes on individual responsibility, that everything that's going to happen, we have to live our lives as though it really is, whether or not we do it or don't do it. Everything that comes to us, live our lives by, it's the result of something that I've done in the past, or it's the result that the result of something that I haven't done and should have done in the past. So theosophy would agree with Ayn Rand in that perspective. But we have to put Ayn Rand, we have to put ourselves in her shoes. She grew up in Russia through communism. And so if we look at her from a compassionate point of view, we have to give a little slack to her, because the other side of her philosophy is pretty much the most raw, selfish perspective of how a human being can be. You know, if basically it's the fittest to survive in the most animalistic way. So theosophy would say, yes, personal responsibility, certainly, but combined with complete compassion and service to others in an effort not to feed them a fish for a day, but to, not even just to teach them how to fish, but to teach them how to teach others how to fish. That's how we should use our resources.
So the individualism of that school of thought you mentioned is individualism of the personality. And we would say that it's a false idea. Why? Because the personality is not eternal. The personality dies with the body. The personality is limited in its capacity. The personality is separative from other personalities. The personality has strengths and weaknesses. It's not all inclusive. So individualism based on personality is a relative false idea. The true idea of individuality is to once again remember that idea of the all-pervasive light or spirit, which like the sun shoots forth its rays. We are all in our highest nature a ray of that sun or that spirit. We all in our highest nature have the same capacities, the same possibilities, the same powers, the same faculties, the same perfectibility as the highest savior who have ever appeared on this earth. The only difference is we don't realize it as individual thinkers. And the other thing is the way we use those capacities is individually determined by our own way we choose to act and think. So our individualism truly is based on ourselves as soul beings, as rays or lights from that universal essence. And because that individuality has its source in that which itself is all pervasive and eternal, we say that it's a right. It's an everlasting, it's a universal idea of individuality that applies to every human being, regardless of their skin, their age, their condition, their intelligence, their experience. They all have the same divine possibility. So we're going to finish here, remind you that next week, continuing this idea of the path of spiritual evolution, we'll have a further presentation on the idea of the plan and purpose of evolution as a process. And also this Wednesday, we have our first study class on reincarnation as a universal doctrine. Our meeting's adjourned.